Are you guys tired of those smug Posturepedic mattress salespeople talking about how much of your time you spend in bed? Well, if you're like me and wear underwear on a regular basis, you're probably spending way more of your life in your underwear. You know, for most of my 20s, I had about 2 laundry cycles worth that would get me through. And I would wear them repeatedly until holes appeared or the waistband gave out or they just physically disintegrated on my body, at which point I would wait for my next birthday or the next Christmas to ask someone for underwear because I just refused to be a smart consumer about underwear. And a few weeks ago, a company by the name of MeUndies.com reached out to me and they sent me a pair of their underwear. And it's just this great fitting underwear that is made of a fabric that is 2 times softer than cotton. It's basically the most comfortable underwear you'll ever wear. But don't take my word for it. You should try it out yourself. Go to MeUndies.com/cracked and you can get 20% off your first order and free shipping. Most pairs of underwear cost $20, which is way less than my previous favorite pair cost. And that can go down to $16 when you buy a 10-pack. And they guarantee you're going to be happy, as do I, but they guarantee it with a money-back guarantee on your first pair. They will give you your first pair for free if you're not happy. And once you feel MeUndies on your body, you will never go back. Once again, go to MeUndies.com/cracked for 20% off your first order and free shipping. Thanks, MeUndies. This episode is also being brought to you by the Seagus V Squared. It's packed with more industry-leading technology than any other phone, up to 464 gigs of storage, a 21-megapixel camera that shoots 4K video, Harman Kardon speakers, lag-free wireless HD streaming to your TV, and the phone is waterproof, which is insane, and you can be among the first to get the V-Squared by going to Indiegogo.com and typing V-Squared into the search bar. Again, that's Indiegogo.com to get your own V-Squared. She told me don't worry about it. She told me don't worry no more. We both know we can't go without it. She told me you'll never be in love. I can feel my face when I'm Internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and this week we're talking about movies. We've covered the fact that I think movies are important because we use movies to fill in the gaps, other countries we've never been to, what Australia looks like, about like America, it turns out, not like the desert wasteland that we all picture because of movies. We use movies to tell us what other people's jobs are like, jobs that aren't ours, how our doctors are supposed to treat us, how cops are supposed to book us. You might think that you get a phone call or that you can't be convicted of a crime if the police fail to read you your rights when they're putting you into handcuffs. Neither of those things are true. Obviously, we don't consciously think, all right, I'm going to use the legal advice I learned from that Richard Gere movie where he played a lawyer. But there's a sort of trickle-down effect. Seeing something happen in a movie kind of makes it possible. It's filmed and framed and beautifully lit by the best visual artists working. And so our brain uses that. And once we see it in a movie, our brain can now go there and imagine that thing happening. And today we're talking about how people decide what things happen in movies, which movies get made, what genres are created in the first place. Like, we're really taking a step back. There's that great monologue about a cultural trickle-down effect in The Devil Wears Prada that I think I've mentioned before, where Meryl Streep's playing sort of a thinly fictionalized version of Anna Wintour, who's trying to decide between 2 belts for an outfit that's gonna be in the spread of Vogue magazine. And Anne Hathaway's character kind of snickers because the belts obviously look identical to her and to the audience. We're with her on this one. And then Anna Wintour says, and I'm going to read some parts from the monologue. She says, oh, okay, I see. You think This has nothing to do with you. You go to your closet and you select, I don't know, that lumpy blue sweater, burn, my burn, that's not in the movie. For instance, because you're trying to tell the world, oh, you take yourself too seriously to care about what you put on your back. But what you don't know is that sweater is not just blue, it's not turquoise, it's not lapis, it's actually cerulean. And you're unaware of the fact that in 2002, Oscar de la Renta did a collection of cerulean gowns, and then Yves Saint Laurent showed cerulean military jackets, and then cerulean quickly showed up in the collections of 8 different designers, and then filtered down through the department stores, and then trickled on down into some tragic casual corner where you fished it out of some clearance bin. Burn, Anne Hathaway, you've been burnt. But it's a great monologue, and I think movies play a similar role when it comes to our imagination. And even that seems limited, because we associate the imagination with children playing make-believe, but it's actually the same faculty that we use when we're making decisions or forming opinions about things we don't have direct experience with, which for me is a lot of things. For me, it includes how cars work, how guns work is a good one. Here, actually, let's listen to NFL wide receiver Plaxico Burress telling the story of how he shot himself with a gun he did not have a permit to be carrying that effectively ended his NFL career in its prime.
And I'm walking up the stairs and I miss a step, and so my gun like slides down my pants. So it's getting ready to hit the ground, so I don't want it to hit the ground. So when it's sliding down my jeans, you know, I go to stop it if I'm hitting the ground.
Now, I want to say real quick here that were I in that same position, I would have instinctively done the same thing. And the reason I now realize is because I've seen guns drop to the ground in movies. And when they hit the ground, they go off, which is a dramatically convenient thing for guns to do in movies. And so I would be, like Plaxico, racing to catch it before it hit the ground and shot people. And the truth is, guns have been built for many decades not to go off when they hit the ground. It's a monetarily inconvenient thing for them to do for their manufacturers. And the first thing you're told at a shooting range is never to try to catch a falling gun, because as Burress explains,
and my finger like hit right on the trigger. Like, it's like, what are the odds of that happening?
The answer is the odds are actually pretty good. And if I had thought about that, I would have known that. Guns are a tool that's designed to be engaged by the human hand and not slapped on the side or dropped like one of those firework firecracker things. They're not a fuzzy TV set that works when you slap it on the side. But my only experience with a falling gun, and probably Burress's only experience with falling guns before that event, were movies like True Lies and I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka, which are making fun of the movie trope of guns falling and going off. It happens so often in movies. And, you know, we have a section of the site called the Personal Experience section where we interview people with experiences that the majority of our readers wouldn't have, that I don't have, that many of our editors don't have. And they don't have to be, like, inherently super interesting jobs. We've had garbage women and zookeepers and nurses. And the one question that we ask all of them that brings out really interesting things each time is, what do you think people might not understand about your experience based on movies that have depicted your job or people like you? And that always works, because what you think about those professions is usually based on the movies you've seen about them. And I've actually seen firsthand a similar trickle-down effect to the one that Meryl Streep describes in Devil Wears Prada. I worked for ABC News before I did this job, and one of the executive producers while I was there had certain shots that every producer knew he was kind of a sucker for, that they had to get as B-roll footage when going out and reporting a story. I think one of them was the moon going behind a cloud. Looks the same whether you're shooting in New Orleans or Moscow, but that's a thing movies might show of something spooky or momentous or, you know, important is about to happen. And so it became a part of these news stories that informed people how the real world works. And that's just like a really specific example that probably didn't change much about how people thought about the world. But it is, like, movies are the best moving photographers working and kind of creating a template for other people to use. And we'll talk about the fact that, you know, superhero movies are the standard go-to type of blockbuster movie for studios to greenlight these days, how it used to be westerns, and, you know, that change. It's something that we kind of take for granted, but why do we start demanding that our heroes be doling out justice in urban environments in elaborate costumes during the 20th century? Is it just that our technology got good enough to show people flying through the air in a realistic enough fashion for movies to show that with a straight face? The Western was preceded by a century in which novels taking place in the West were popular, and comic books were preceded by a century of superhero comic books being extremely popular. So where did that initial fascination come from? Why those elaborate fictional scenarios? So that's what we're going to be talking about. And yeah, I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then.
We both know we can't go without it. She told me you'll never be alone. I can feel my face when I'm with you.
I am joined by David Bell. What up, David?
Hey, how's it going?
And Serge, Joshua Sargent. How's it going, man?
Good. I like cool. Serge as my
Serge
as my podcast name.
It's your liberal French member of La Resistance podcast persona.
Yeah, we don't need to go into my revolutionary days.
I guess one of the kind of standard tropes on this podcast is that we talk about how movies are really influential on how people think of things, like either, whether it be a era in history or another country. Basically, if you haven't been there before, we've found, at least when publishing articles on Cracked and sort of the response that we've gotten from readers, is that the touchstones that they use to sort of imagine those places and kind of figure out everything they know about things that they don't know about is movies. And so what we're talking about today is sort of how movies and other types of popular fiction get made. Like, who decides that now we make all superhero movies, whereas when our grandparents were kids, they were having the same conversations about other genres. And, you know, is that steered by just some random guy in Hollywood, like winning a bet and being like, I bet I can make the most successful movie this year be The Rock flying a helicopter around and ignoring people who are drowning to death in a comically small helmet? Or is it something inherent to the human imagination that, like, steers that? What is it, man? Let's start with superhero movies, right? Superhero movies are certainly a trend. They've certainly
superhero
had
movies
a run.
And sequels. My theory on that is tying it to 9/11.
Which he does constantly.
Yes, I do.
With everything.
Yeah, no.
We were choosing which person sat at which mic earlier, and he compared 9/11. It to 9/11. Yeah. Those two tall ones are kind of like the Twin Towers, whereas this one I'm on is like the Pentagon.
And I think it's interesting because we both have a theory about why 9/11 caused superhero movies, but they're different theories, and they're probably both right.
Yeah, and I
think, I'm more right, but so
sure.
You can go first.
Sure. I think this happens to in any era. We were talking earlier, me and Josh, about Westerns as well, is that Westerns tend to change depending on what's going on in the country. Like, a good example is when Reagan became president, he was sort of known as this kind of cowboy, and that's when Westerns went on a more of a decline. And the same thing happened with Bush, and they were at their most popular right after World War II as well.
So you're saying that they became unpopular because the president was one?
That it just coincides with that. It's my theory of certain genres that come and go, like musicals, westerns, superhero films, are kind of the result of some sort of general national mood.
Yeah, we've covered on the site before that we'll make more zombie movies, and zombie movies will do better when there's a Republican in office.
Right.
Because the people who are scared are Democrats, and they view their opponent as mouth-breathing masses. And then when there's a Democrat in office, the most popular movies are vampire movies, because they're these, like, strange foreign metrosexual people who, like, invade and, like, have strange sexuality, ambiguous sexuality.
Yeah, the horror films represent different repressed fears. And I think when you look at the heroes in movies, you see the opposite of that. Instead of fears, you see how people see themselves. And I mean, the way I would tie superheroes to 9/11, which, you know, we must, to justify that, 2001, obviously, yeah, is when that happened. 2002 was when Spider-Man was released. That crushed the box office, that decimated everything. And it really did kick off a new direction for superhero movies, where they were far more CGI-driven than they ever had been. David pointed this out, that Spider-Man was all CGI for a lot of scenes, and it was kind of a bigger superhero movie. Before that, we got X-Men, we got Batman, and those were a little bit more grounded, where Spider-Man's swinging around in buildings and stuff.
Yeah, I don't know if I buy that 9/11 informed superhero movies in that way. Like, Westerns were the most popular type of penny store novels, like during the 1800s and early 1900s, right? Like, everybody read Westerns. And then after World War II, America had excess income, and so they started making more movies and created a whole genre. Like, they had the technology now and the money to make the types of stories that people were just reading in novels before. And with comic books, like, people had been reading superhero stories all through the 20th century, and then the technology just sort of caught up, and
we immediately
that ties into musicals as well, because the moment we could put sound in film is the moment we started doing a bunch of musicals, because we just could, and we loved musicals before that, and so we have the ability to do the thing that we can't.
Yeah, but for some reason musicals are out of fashion now.
Right.
Like, the first thing we thought to do with them was shoot them in movies. But there is something about movies that, like, you don't need to make them musicals because you have the soundtrack. You can just, like, put in a rock song behind someone and it's like, oh, he doesn't look weird now. Whereas with a musical, you have to have the person break into song, which is always inherently embarrassing.
Right. It's weird that we dug that in the 80s too, where people, there would always be a, they'd stop and do a musical number, like in Back to the Future or Revenge of the Nerds. Like, that was a weird fad that we loved.
Back to the Future?
He stops and he plays for the...
Yeah, we get all of Johnny Be Good at the end.
Oh, right,
and then
right.
They tried to do the exact same thing at the end of Accepted when Justin Long sings Blitzkrieg Bop, and it doesn't quite work as well. Accepted is obviously a classic film now, but...
Right, yeah. Which one of those did better, I wonder? Yeah, that is weird. Like, we do need music in some way, and this is something we've talked about, I think, on After Hours, the idea that the way that musicals operate actually might be more human than everyday life, in the sense that we used to use, like, music, and we used to sing songs, and, like, the thing we had before the written record was, like, these epic poems that rhymed and that were, like, said in a certain rhythm, and music has always been, like, really fundamental to what it meant to be human, and lots of other animals use music, and so the fact that we would invent this sort of alternate reality where we get to tell people what our mood is in song, that seems actually logical to me. Whereas I think for most of my life I thought of musicals as this, like, weird artificial invention.
I think it's a combination of technology, like CGI, access to new technology, but also it's definitely specific to our country. If you go and look at the top films for 2014 in other countries, they'll have, in the mix of superhero films, they'll have buddy comedies and adult situation comedies, which is something we've completely lost now. And so that's why I think, like, it's one of those things where if CGI was the main factor for why we're obsessed with a certain genre.
Completely lost in the box office, you mean, right? Like, they still happen, but they just, people don't care?
Yeah, but they're not in the top 10 for the U.S., which is
so
different.
Let's go through some of the other countries that you're talking about here. England was interesting. So the number one movie is The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, which is typical. You'd expect the British to... Basically, that's just about a bunch of British people, isn't it? Like, different heights... British people.
Sure. Yeah, I believe it takes place in contemporary England.
Paddington is number two. That's surprising.
That couldn't be more British, though.
They're so living in their glory years when, like, they had the best writers. But anyways, the Lego Movie. The Inbetweeners 2, which we aren't even mostly...
I have no idea what that is.
Right.
And I don't know what the Inbetweeners 1 was.
That made 50 million in
pounds.
England.
50 million pounds?
Sure, sure. No, I think it's the dollars on this list.
They finally wised up?
Sure. And that was, yeah, an adult comedy. It's a...
It looks like a teen comedy.
It's basically like grown-ups, but with teens. It's a bunch of guys reuniting at a water park.
Oh, I get it. Yeah, this was an MTV show they tried to make where it's about people, it's sort of Freaks and Geeks. It's about people who aren't the biggest nerds and aren't like the biggest jocks. They're just the normal people. So it's a personality-driven comedy, basically. Right. It's what we don't, another thing we don't have here in America is TV shows that become huge, awesome movies, usually. They're like somewhat successful, but they're not going to be in our top 10. They liked The Hunger Games. The number 7 on their list is a Hunger Games movie. They got behind Guardians of the Galaxy, How to Train Your Dragon 2, Spider-Man 2. So they look somewhat like us, except for a few adult comedies. When you look at America, let's go up to America real quick. You have American Sniper, The Hunger Games, Guardians of the Galaxy, Captain America, The Lego Movie, The Hobbit, Transform. So it's all big box office blockbusters and American Sniper, which was a surprise hit and got us right in our soft spot of Americans killing foreign people, yeah. I guess.
It is the best thing.
Yeah. And France, what do we have here?
France, it's all unpronounceable. I'm not even going to try.
Oh, Lucy's up there.
Someone can try.
But the top three are...
Qu'est-ce qu'on en fait bon bon?
Are French movies, yeah?
Yeah, very French movies. But they're all, again, adult comedies.
And then Lucy and Dawn of Lucy, the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
That's so funny that one French director that we keep letting make crazy-ass movies is, like, their favorite director. He's their modern-day Jerry Lewis.
What is his name? Luc Besson?
Yeah.
Besson? Luc Besson? I may have hyper-foreignized it to Besson.
You don't have to give us the dumb American pronunciation, I think.
He made The Fifth Element,
which is
a fantastic movie. Just in case, I mean, I know you know Jack.
He's a legend.
Our listeners know.
And what you're saying is everybody's top 10 has movies from America on them. America is the only one that seems to be all movies that are somewhat aimed at a foreign audience except for American Sniper, which is, like, super hyper-American, right? I can't imagine that did very well anywhere else.
Yeah, and Captain America also doesn't show up that much on the other lists.
There's nothing on our list that isn't heavy special effects. I assume there's a lot of explosions in American Sniper. I did not see it.
There's not that many.
There's some explosions.
I don't know how big the budget was, though.
Well, it's still just the subject matter, which is a sniper who suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder, and that is also kind of still is in line with the post 9/11 thing, as far as my theory of that goes.
Okay.
Which is that after 9/11, our movies focused more, the superhero movies got a lot more destruction porn in them, kind of accelerating up. We got the Transformers franchise took off, and you get buildings falling over all the time, and that I could notice that similarity to Japanese filmmaking after the Lucky Dragon 5 accident, which is when a Japanese fishing ship was destroyed by a new American nuclear weapons test, and then right after that, Godzilla came out, and the opening shot of the first Godzilla movie is that recreated, only instead of a nuclear blast, it's Godzilla. And all kinds of articles online and anywhere you can go read about how Godzilla was very much Japan working through the trauma of suffering from a nuclear attack, obviously.
Yeah.
And by recreating it on film in the new context, this destruction of a city via a foreign entity that comes in and just wreaks havoc for what seems like no reason. And I think you could see something similar in heavy destruction porn in American film and like exploration of these ideas where we're recreating a very frightening thing in a way that we can control and fantasize about and putting an invulnerable avatar for ourselves in the middle of it, like Superman or Spider-Man or
the Avengers.
The Avengers,
the central climax of that movie is it's an attack on New York City where, like, buildings are falling down, and it's just, you know, what if the Avengers had been there? I definitely think that it influenced the images that appeared within those movies, for sure. Like, the falling buildings, definitely. And, like, the fact that you see so much urban destruction and people looking up at the sky and, like, specific choices. A good example was, I think it was either Spider-Man or Spider-Man 2, where the poster for that movie...
Spider-Man 1
was
the first one.
A helicopter caught in a spider web between the Twin Towers. So, obviously, that's not cool.
Yeah. After
September 11th.
That was a teaser for that. That was immediately pulled.
Right.
I worked at a movie theater at the time, and I remember all the trailers just mysteriously disappeared because everybody knew they were worth something.
Yeah, so it's definitely influenced by our experiences and stuff. But I also wonder, like, Tim Burton made the first Batman and it treated everything like it was a joke. And there were a lot of weird sound effects and fantastical things happening. And then we had to figure out, no, people take these seriously like they do in the comic books, and now we can make them look better. Like, even the first Spider-Man, when you look at it now, looks like a video game almost, with the CGI of him swinging through the streets. But it seems like Americans in particular assume that these other countries just are lapping it up, like, are eating up all these foreign movies that we're making. And that's not necessarily the case. I found it really interesting that The Wolf of Wall Street was extremely popular in Germany.
Yeah, Germany is very confusing there, apparently. Because they also like that weird French movie as well, which is the adult comedy. The one that surprised me the most, though, was China, because we've been talking a lot about how we're making movies to appeal to them more. And when you look at the list, like, they barely have American movies on their top 10 list. Besides Transformers, which was, of course, number one, they have something called Breakup Buddies as their number two, which made $187 million. It's an adult comedy, again, about two people, one guy helping another guy get over a breakup or something like that. And what that reminds me of a lot is more like the 90s in America, where we actually would have films like that that were would make that much money.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that Breakup Buddies reminded you of the number 10 film, The Breakup Guru.
Which apparently, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that makes some sense to me because it's a huge economy that is advanced, and so they have money to make movies for themselves. And
that's true.
That are specifically aimed at their enormous exploding population. I think it's interesting, Captain America was one of the top 10 movies in China, and that year, what is this, 2014? Captain America Winter Soldier, for some reason, was popular over there. And that actually, when you said that the fact that they were able to make a Captain America movie before a movie with a female superhero is insane, because, like, one of the first things you hear when people say, well, why hasn't Marvel made a movie for, you know, Black Widow? One of the arguments is, oh, foreign audiences don't go to see female led movies. They only want to see male-led movies. But they got past that for a movie called Captain America. Like, that was okay.
Yeah, and in Japan, Frozen is number one. So, like, they clearly don't have too much of a problem with female-led movies either.
Yeah, but Japan's weird.
Yeah.
I do wonder how different things would be, or if 9/11 just made it so there's, like, less things that you can do. Like, you can't have Spider-Man just create a fucking spider web between the Twin Towers that captures aircraft.
It's weird that we thought that we'd be sensitive about that, and then, like, it only took, like, 10 years that, like, I look at the new Star Trek sequel, where he just 9/11s an entire city with that, with the Enterprise.
Right.
Like, we're totally fine with that now.
Can you describe that?
I love it.
What happens in that movie?
I didn't Khan see. Is just pissed and flies. I believe it's the, is it the Enterprise or is it
no
the,
it's the bigger one. There's some the super enterprise.
He flies that into San Francisco and just 9/11's the shit out of San Francisco. That's the only way to describe it. It's just, he's clearly using 9/11 imagery to show that
the spaceship is the size of San Francisco, and he crashes it through the entire city and kills millions of people.
That's what I'm noticing about 2004's top box office in America, is that most of them have, like, some sort of 9/11 event. Guardians of the Galaxy has an entire spaceship crash into a city.
2014, is it?
Sorry, yeah. Captain America has the helicarriers crashing into the ground. The Lego movie even has, like, a citywide destruction in their little Lego city.
Mm-hmm.
Transformers has the aliens come. I'm pretty sure there's got to be something running into a building in there.
Man, things happened in that movie.
Yeah, X-Men. Even X-Men has him ruining a stadium in this giant act of terrorism. Like, we put that element in everything now.
Yeah, but it's weird. The stadium thing is something that's been happening since the 70s. I almost wonder if, like, that will be the next real attack that will happen, because it's like, we've been doing that for a long time. And even in Dark Knight Rises, they, like, showed a stadium attack. There's a popular novel called Black Sunday or something.
where some guy holds the Super Bowl hostage.
That is strange because
it's only
yeah,
a matter of time.
Writers have been imagining that for years.
Yeah.
I think of
maybe there's some technical difficulty that makes it harder than writers think.
Oh, I was just going to mention also the Sum of All Fears does that as well. Oh. But yeah, you're right. Maybe they're just more protected than the White House. We don't even realize it.
Hey guys, as I mentioned up top, this episode is brought to you by the Sagus V-Squared smartphone. Now you might be saying, wait, I've never heard any of those words before, if you skipped past the intro especially. And you'd be right, you probably haven't heard of Sagus or the V-Squared before. This is a brand new smartphone from a bunch of guys who've been working behind the scenes in the industry for years and decided, screw it, we're making our own phone. We've had enough of these trips to the Apple store where you're forced to put your life in the hands of someone with genius on their business card. That's never a good idea. That's never a good feeling. The Sagus V-Square is packed with all sorts of industry-leading technology. It comes with 64 gigs of storage standard and has two micro SD slots, so you can have up to 464 gigs in case you wanted to carry around the entirety of all human knowledge at all times. It has a 21 megapixel camera on the back that shoots 4K video, which means that our fancy pants directors who make cracked videos could shoot those videos on this phone. And it has a 12 megapixel front facing camera as well, which basically means that the worst camera on this phone is better than the best camera on almost every other phone. What else? The Harman Kardon speakers, lag-free wireless HD streaming to your TV, and it's waterproof, which, trust me, that comes in handy. We interviewed somebody who fixes smartphones for a living, and this is the number one way smartphones get broken, is dropped in a bowl of water that we will not presume is the toilet, but it happens. And a really cool thing about this product is that they're launching this, their first smartphone, the V-Squared, on Indiegogo right now. I mean, music got better with the internet because it dropped all the barriers to entry, and that process made podcasts possible. And now it's time for the same thing to happen to the devices that we listen to music and podcasts on. So go over to Indiegogo.com and type V-Squared into the search bar. You can buy a V-Squared today and support tech that pushes the boundaries of what is possible. We're also sponsored today by Parachute. You know when you're trying to get to sleep and you just can't get your body right and the distribution of your body heat is all messed up under the covers, and then there's like a random itch that shows up, and I haven't had that feeling in weeks. I fall asleep faster than you, and it's because of Parachute. Parachute's an online luxury bedding brand based in Venice Beach, California, and they've created a line of everyday bedding essentials to enhance your sleep. Sheets, pillowcases, duvet inserts, cashmere blankets, and even candles, and not at a luxury price. Parachute's bedding is premium quality and toxic-free, meaning no harmful chemicals or synthetic finishes used, and their sheets are made of the best cotton in the world, 100% long staple Egyptian cotton, but you can actually really feel the difference when you sleep on Parachute products. One of the cool things about Parachute is they're manufactured in a mill in Tuscany that's been weaving bedding for 80 years, and it just comes fresh off the loom, and they ship it directly to your door. It's a direct-to-consumer model, meaning Parachute cuts out the licensing and distribution fees, which is how they're able to let you experience luxury bedding for less money than you would have ever paid before. No more paying extra so Martha Stewart can get a cut, or whoever gets a cut of your bedding. So go to parachutehome.com/crack, and Parachute will give you $25 off on your first order with coupon code CRACKED, C-R-A-C-K-E-D. So that's parachute.com/cracked and enter CRACKED for $25 off at checkout, and you can start sleeping as well as I've been sleeping for the past few weeks thanks to Parachute. Just
just in terms of giving some context for like how successful current movies are compared to the past. Like, so for the past, I think we have the records back through 1990 full year. The number of tickets sold has been between 1.56 billion tickets sold in America in 2002 and 1.09 billion in 1992. And even in the last 5 years, it's been like between 1.4 billion and 1.27 billion. So it's not growing or shrinking that much, even though the prices of tickets have gone up.
Yeah, one thing that I've been wondering is because adults tend to be not the primary people who go to movies, but they're a big chunk of movie audiences. And what I've been reading is that adult audiences have been slowly declining. And that's the reason why there's a slow decline. There's also piracy. But yeah, it hasn't been that much of a difference, I guess. My theory is it's about audiences sort of shifting more than declining.
Wouldn't audiences shift like more on the young side as they like learn?
Yeah, there's also piracy, which is kind of affects that as well. But yeah, the fact that PG-13 or movies are now PG-13, that movies are just less geared towards adults than they used to be, which is sort of what Simon Pegg was talking about, where he talked about how we're sort of stuck in this adolescence with our movies right now.
We're trying to drag stuff that was designed for kids or at least as light entertainment into adulthood, and by making it Star Trek stories that are real and adulty, and Watchmen being an example in superhero movies that tackle these grand themes when they weren't created for that purpose. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think people react to that like, oh, we can do serious work with our characters, and yeah, you can tell cool serious adult stories with Iron Man. It's happened, but it's weird to insist to kind of drag them all in that direction rather than tell stories that were explicitly written to make those kinds of points.
Yeah, and that does seem like, I wonder how much that's an invention of marketers or if that's a thing that is actually true, right? Because American Sniper is a movie that was like the big shocking surprise hit of last year, and that's like for adults, and it's a story about an adult, and that was shocking to everybody. But there's also a sense like, when you go back and look at the most successful movie, like every year for the past like 100 years, it used to be stuff like The Godfather, and on a past episode, Jason brought up Kramer versus Kramer, and even Jaws was like the first huge summer blockbuster movie, like the first popcorn movie that's made in the image of what will be this summer's, which is the Jurassic World movie that just like broke every record. But that movie is, instead of having like a grown-up man-child who like plays with raptors for a living and like is considered undateable by this woman who like he can't socialize with normal human beings, Jaws had like an alcoholic sheriff who like had baggage as his like as the central character, and like the thing that motivates him is his love for his son. Like, he sees the shark swim past his son and he's like, all right, I'm really gonna kill this bitch. So it's like very centered in an adult point of view, whereas that would never happen today. Like, you would never have the inciting incident for like the main character to go out and kill the big monster be something that only an adult could really identify with. It seems like you need to be appealing to kids. Like, you need all four quadrants: young men, young women, older men, older women, or at least that's like the way people think these days.
It's definitely broader now, because you look back, I mean, we still have them every now and then, but I feel like there's also films like The Lion King and Aladdin and Home Alone. Like, those were not films for everybody, and they were the highest grossing film that year.
Right.
Like, we've sort of lost genre films, is what I feel like. Like, we used to have, in the 70s, I mean, The Exorcist was the top grossing film of its year. When's the last time a horror movie has made the top of the box office?
Yeah, you were pointing out something interesting in the article, your article that went up today, that horror movies at least seem to make this assumption that they should have teenagers. Like, teenagers are the people we want to see scared and killed in our horror movies. And when you look at the most successful horror movies, it's very much like an adult or a child. It's like,
it's usually about parenthood.
Right.
It's something like The Shining or The Omen or The Exorcist, where it's an adult and a child going through this as opposed to some teenager.
The Sixth Sense.
That ties back to what you're saying about how the popular monsters reflect a fear, like zombies reflect Republicans, and vampires, I guess, reflect gay liberals. But probably the most powerful fear you can tap into is those associated with parenthood.
Yeah, like
the most primal.
It's the most primal thing we have, so it makes sense to kind of screw with that in a horror movie. And it's not like teenage films don't do great. There's a lot of classics, but it's the fact that the highest grossing is consistently starring adults.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. It's What Lies Beneath is on there. World War Z. I don't know if I would actually call that a horror movie.
What Lies Beneath? That is shocking.
I love that movie. You know what's the most shocking part of that is Clark Gregg wrote it, who's he plays Agent Coulson in the Avengers movies.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Not weird.
That movie is baffling because nobody remembers it. Like, I have fond memories of it. We watched it the other night. It was really... I really like it, but nobody remembers it. It's like the fourth highest grossing horror movie of all time. And Robert Zemeckis made it while making Castaway, just as a thing to do while Tom Hanks, like, loses weight.
It says second highest grossing on this list.
Oh, really?
It probably depends on who's counting and how.
Yeah, it also depends on your definition. Like, Jaws is on a lot of lists, which I would say, you know, it's technically horror, but I don't think people consider it horror anymore. And, yeah, World War Z is sort of on the line. So it kind of depends on which list of horror films you look at, but it's always up there.
Yeah, but I think that kind of gets it. Just looking at it over time, you see, okay, there's this lesson that was learned by Hollywood at a certain point that, okay, we need to have this four-quadrant movie with the young, the old, and both sexes. So movies start heading in that direction where you see like a lot of movies programmed for sort of that adolescent standpoint. And even when you just look at, in general, like commercials and the things that the people that marketing is aimed at, we've gone in a direction from, like, back in the Mad Men era, it was, like, assumed that you're an adult. We make movies for adults, and you see that. And, like, The Godfather is the number one movie in 1972, The Exorcist, 1973, Blazing Saddles, a race comedy, in 1974, and then Jaws, Rocky, the first Rocky's a pretty, you know, adult movie, but then Star Wars happens, Grease, so they're still making musicals, but then Kramer versus Kramer is the number one movie in 1979.
I have a question. What if we go further back in time, like down, because I was reading about like the dawn of film, and it was very much a spectacle thing. And
yeah, then with each The Birth of a Nation, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
I was thinking, because film started as just, here's some footage of people walking out of a factory, like workers leaving the factory, and everyone was like, oh my God, this is the craziest thing I've ever seen. And then it kind of seems like we're coming back to that with Avatar. Things that the story doesn't matter as much, we just get back to, like you were saying, oh, we get some imagery, some 9/11 imagery, we get Avatar, which is computers, and it's
yeah,
like come full circle.
Yeah, I mean, I do think Avatar seemed to be sort of like what The Wizard of Oz or The Jazz Singer were in their time. It's like not necessarily a great movie. You can't just like appreciate the traditional, you know, the framing and the mise-en-scene and the acting necessarily, but it's an advance forward in like sort of the technology of movie making. And I think that'll continue to be there. We like nothing's been nearly as good as Avatar at that technology. And so I think people kind of don't remember why they liked Avatar in the first place.
I have no idea if it holds up because I haven't even thought about watching it since I saw it the first time.
But it does seem like there's something to Simon Pegg's point about like how we only make movies that are based on things that adolescents are into, because I don't know if there's something about the culture now where we just value the young and are like hate the old. I guess they made Gone Girl and that was a hit, but by the end of the year nobody was like talking about that. It was not a monster hit compared to like Guardians of the Galaxy and like the other movies that came out that year.
Right. And I think another factor, of course, is the internet and nostalgia, which we're actually working on an article about why nostalgia has actually changed, like why it's just not the same as it used to be. And one of the factors is the internet gives us the ability to sort of go back and look at our past more and to celebrate it more. And demands for films like Jurassic World and stuff like that are kind of rising because we want to bring that back. You know, we can now bring back Reading Rainbow on Kickstarter if we want to. Like, it's way easier to dwell on our past with the internet.
when I was growing up, nostalgia was like, you couldn't go back and watch the shows you watched when you were growing up. You could like have a Transformers t-shirt, but now you can go on YouTube and actually watch old episodes of Transformers and realize
that it's terrible.
Yeah. Has that changed things? Like, because I definitely feel less nostalgia for things that happened 10 years ago, but that might just be because I'm in my 50s now.
That's true. That's the other factor. Is right. Like, is it that? Because that's the thing, is that when people say movies suck now or something like that, you look at the box office and like they're clearly getting better at making more money making movies. So it's about your definition of quality, and it's the idea of, like, I realized, I saw Jurassic World and I realized, like, oh God, this movie isn't for me. You know, I'm about 30. I'm sure people like it, but it's not geared towards me anymore. I'm not the demographic they're going after.
Who do you think it's for?
I think it's sort of trying to bridge. It's trying to do the Star Wars episode one thing, where it's trying to get a new audience while sort of, while sort of nodding to the old audience. Because have you seen it yet?
No.
There's a character in it who very much represents, or it's supposed to represent, me, which is the age Jurassic Park fan who, like, it's a guy who literally is wearing a Jurassic Park t-shirt that's all beat up, and who talks about how great the original park was, which makes no sense in the context of the film, but it's clearly like this wink to the audience of like, oh yeah, we get it, you know, you love the original one. So it's that, plus then they're trying to sort of move on and like appeal to younger audiences at the same time.
And it's like a knowing nostalgia that like doesn't actually feel that much affection for the earlier work, I guess. It's like kind of doing it with a wink and a nod, and then that guy gets eaten or something.
No, he doesn't get eaten. I was personally upset about this, is just because he goes off on the product placement. He says, like, oh, corporations got to get involved in everything. They're going to name something like Pepsisaurus. And then the film, like, tries to break a record for how much product placement they can stick in their movie after that moment. So it's that thing where they're trying to be self-aware, but if they were that self-aware, they would avoid doing the things that they're complaining about. I mean, other people probably have different opinions on this. For me, it was just felt weird and kind of almost insulting.
That's also interesting because I've heard that from smart people who watch it, it's like a failed social satire, or like a failed satire of blockbuster movies.
I definitely got the vibe that it feels like a movie that got rewritten by different people.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so many things that are set up and never pay off, and there's so many weird character decisions that just don't make any sense. And like there's one death scene where you're clearly supposed to feel like it's a death scene that's for a villainous character, but it happens to a character that we actually sort of feel like we should like, or at least not have any special feelings towards, and it just comes off as very gratuitous.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of points out, like, it's just you know, the Gennaro scene in Jurassic Park, which happens when the Tyrannosaurus Rex eats the lawyer, and we've spent the whole beginning of the movie just hating this lawyer for being such a jerk, so it's like a fist pumping moment.
Right.
It's kind of like if that happened to like Ian Malcolm, where it's like, you're not charming, but you're kind of goofy, and like this horrible thing is happening to you, and I feel gross.
Right.
So it just seems like, I bet at one point the movie had something really clever to say about CGI and about the state of filmmaking, because the premise, which is this genetically modified dinosaur that's running rampant through, and like that's a good extension of the Jurassic Park idea. Like, oh, we made dinosaurs. Oh, now we made something worse because our arrogance. You're upping the stakes in every way. But so much of what they say about the dinosaur doesn't end up being true, or is contradicted by how the dinosaur acts. And there's so many other ideas, like they throw in a little bit of a blackfish thing where they talk about how the dinosaur is raised in captivity, so he's crazy, but then that doesn't pan out or mean anything.
Huh.
So it just seems like they rewrote the movie a few times. I enjoyed watching it. Like, I didn't hate it as much as David did, but I also, like, I don't think it was a good...
But it is a surprise hit. Like, the reaction to the, like, where we are about a week in to its run at the box office is that, like, oh wow, this is the most successful movie ever. Like, one of the most, and nobody expected that. Nobody saw that coming. And probably has something to do with nostalgia in a way. It's a movie that the first version held up, and they hadn't really revisited it in a way that was satisfying, and so they just got that out of their system.
Yeah, and they sort of promised to go back to the original park a bit, which none of the other sequels had really done. And it does feel like it's the perfect timing, because like Age of Ultron did really well, but I think a lot of people were less satisfied with how that came out. And I think superhero films, at least to me, feel like they're kind of winding down a little bit. And so like stuff like Star Wars and Jurassic Park, these new, you know, appealing to our older nostalgia is coming back. And I think there's going to be kind of an explosion there where we're going to see the newer thing that we love and sort of grab at that instead. I'm sure superhero films will be around for a while still.
Yeah. Is it different in some way from the first Batman movie becoming really successful and grabbing at the nostalgia for people who read Batman comics growing up? Or like Cracked, we specifically launched Cracked as an old humor brand that right. people felt nostalgia for? That's not true. It's a complete accident.
Yeah, I don't know. The first Batman, didn't that piss off a lot of fans too? Because it wasn't...
Sure, just like every movie.
That happens.
But like, I guess, what conclusions are you guys drawing about modern nostalgia versus like nostalgia in the past?
My, I guess it would be complaint for this is that I think movies now are made kind of planning to be box office hits. Now, right. where when Guardians of the Galaxy comes out, well, this is, it's a cinematic universe, that's a bad example, but like, or Jurassic World, like, they already know they're making sequels. They don't even have them written yet. And I know that's not too new, like, when Jurassic Park did really well, they went to Michael Crichton, they're like, write a sequel so we can make the sequel. But normally, films felt like they came out more organically than they do now, where it feels like now it's more like they have the formula down. And they're sort of manufacturing movies.
They cost more now, right?
Oh, yeah. And but so they're making more,
It's a bigger industry.
It's working. I mean, you need the money men to be more in charge. And
yeah. Let's look at Jurassic Park in particular. Jurassic Park the first, as it was called. That was just based on like a great idea Michael Crichton came up with. They looked at all the novels that were bestsellers for the past 10 years and were like, oh man, this is the best idea. If we give it to Spielberg, he has such a great history with these types of movies. It's perfect, so we'll invest a bunch of money in it. It was a huge hit, like they thought. Rather than being like, okay, we're the money guys. We made a good decision there. Let's figure out what the next sequel should be. They were like, hey, Michael Crichton, why don't you write us up another sequel and we'll just assume it's going to be brilliant, which it wasn't, right?
Yeah, and it didn't. Yeah, The Lost World.
It did fine, but it wasn't the phenomenon that the first Jurassic Park was. And then the third one never happened. And so this one, they specifically say, okay, let's come up with a premise that revives Jurassic Park. What if the park actually opened? That's a great premise. That should have been the second premise, but mm-hmm. Michael Crichton didn't think of it. So the people who are in charge of making up premises came up with the best premise on this one. And I feel like that's how movies get made now, is like at the premise stage. Like, what if Jurassic Park opened like Disney World?
Yeah, and there's a lot of like, with the new Wonder Woman, they just threw it at five writers and they're just like, write screenplays. And they're just trying to find the one that works. Like, there's this feeling, like, that's what's so weird about Marvel coming out and being like, here's all the films you'll be watching for the next 10 years. It's like, shouldn't you be writing the scripts first and then figuring it out from there? Like, going from the story and then judging if it's going to get made, not being like, it's going to get made. Now let's figure out what the story and characters are and what's going to happen. And yeah, it seems like they're starting more from premise. Like, Jurassic World was, they've been talking about making a sequel forever now, and they had so many bad ideas. They had the one about human-dinosaur hybrids.
That was like the Island of Dr. Moreau.
Yeah. I would have seen the shit out of that movie. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, that would have been, it would have done terrible, though.
Yeah.
They remade Island of Dr. Moreau. It didn't go well. There is an assumption that movies are getting worse, right? Or at least, like, you hear that a lot.
I personally don't agree with that.
Yeah, I also don't.
I don't like movies currently, but I still don't think they're getting worse, because I think it is a symptom of a sort of cultural thing, like Westerns or like musicals, where we kind of hit these weird bumps where we just get really into something and then it slowly dissolves.
They're getting better at making this certain type of film. Like, if you go back and look at the top blockbuster movies since the 70s, Jaws hits and it's like, oh shit, that was twice as big as any movie before it in terms of how much money it made. So let's start thinking that big. And so, you know, there's more Spielberg movies, but it's like 5-10 years later. You're only learning the message of like a huge hit and like how to replicate that over the course of a decade, really. Mm-hmm. And slowly those crowd out anything else. Like those huge grand slam blockbuster movies that make over $200 million slowly start to crowd out the movies like Kramer versus Kramer, which still get made.
they just don't seem like that big of a hit. If we were still just making movies the way that they did in the 70s, then Gone Girl would have been the most successful movie of last year. And it was mm-hmm. just a pretty straightforward adaptation of a best-selling novel. Those still get made into movies, and they're pretty big, but they're not as big as these things that overshadow them.
And they probably still last for a while afterwards, because we're just looking at the top films per year.
Right.
Which, it is almost a guarantee that these films will be remembered, because, you know, every film on this list is a classic, or in the past, like, yeah, Jaws and Back to the Future and Batman and all that.
Yeah. I guess the, like, production process has gotten more refined, maybe. Like, they're better at, like, figuring out what premises to invest in, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get better movies. I don't know where you'd see us Pulp Fiction today. Probably like from Korea, a great filmmaker with a distinct voice, just yeah. like nailing it without a premise that anybody can possibly relate to.
Yeah, and part of the using really safe premises usually involves a lot of sequeling. And when you're sequeling and controlling a franchise, then you usually put a director on it that doesn't have a unique voice. Colin Trevorrow for Jurassic World, they try to put like a new director on there that the producers know they can control. A kind of a classic example that backfired was Alien 3, because Fincher turned out to be a genius, even though he was like,
oh, that's interesting,
13 years old when they hired him to direct Alien 3.
Yeah, so this Colin Trevorrow guy made the guy who directed Jurassic World made a small movie called
Safety Not Guaranteed
that wasn't great. Like, I watched it. Did you guys see it?
I did not see it.
It's like an average-ish movie. And for some reason, the studio was like, there's our guy for Jurassic Park. Like, there's no effects.
The director of Godzilla had made an indie movie called Monsters that was entirely improv, the dialogue, I think. And you can tell when you watch it that it very clearly.
But that one seemed to be, like, Monsters was all about monsters that, like, he uses the, like, Jaws effect where you don't see the monsters, right?
I think, you never see him.
You see him at the end.
And, like, in Godzilla, that was sort of, like, what he did that was somewhat unique.
Yeah, and both films kind of had the same problem, where Monsters, it was like, this could be a cool idea if I liked any of these characters.
Right.
And then Godzilla's the same way. It's just like, yeah, I'm fine with focusing just... Because Jurassic Park, you'd barely see the dinosaurs. You know, the first attack is at the midpoint. And that's fine, because you like the characters, and you're rooting for them, and you're going along with them. And Godzilla is just like, oh, hey, never mind, he's dead. So,
but in that case, they like took a guy who had made a successful small low budget movie, and were like, here, what do you do with $1 billion? And it did fine, but it wasn't like the biggest movie ever. Whereas Jurassic World never made sense to me, because his first movie was so unremarkable, mm-hmm. and you're saying that. You think it's because that's part of the same process, like the way that like they're creating the premise to get the biggest audience. They're also hiring the director to not fuck with the people who created
yeah.
the premise.
Yeah, I know that was explicitly the reason Fincher was hired for Alien 3, is because he was actually significantly older than 13 years old. That was a joke, but he had only done music videos before, and they brought him on. He was younger than all the actors, and they just assumed that he would just do whatever they said. Because Alien 3, they started filming it. They'd built sets, but they didn't have a script. And they were like, start shooting in a week or something. Like, it was insane. Right.
Wasn't it like a wooden planet or something?
The original draft, the story was a Vince Ward came up with the idea of it would be on a wooden Death Star populated by monks. And the alien would crash on there, and they would mainly hunt it in their cornfields on their giant wooden planet. And then he pitched that, because he made it up on the way to the meeting, I think, on the airplane. He pitched it, and they accepted, and Vince Ward was shocked.
Right.
And so he started making the movie, and then it's coming up to the moment when they're going to start filming it. And according to the documentary about the making of the movie, it's like they're coming up to make the movie, and suddenly the producers are like, so wait, how does this wooden planet work?
Right.
And Vincent Ward's like, are you kidding? You can't bring that up now.
Right.
You can't just freak out about my freaky idea weeks before we start shooting. So he ended up either quitting or getting fired, and they brought on David Fincher at the last second, because they thought, well, this guy will do whatever we say. He's going to be so thankful that we've given him this big project. He doesn't want to mess with his career, so he'll do anything. But then he ended up being a genius, and the movie is pretty bad, but watchable because of him.
But that is a strategy that seems like it's now what people do with the next big movie. Joss Whedon is a person who had a following with like fans, but he had never directed like a huge budget movie. That's mm-hmm. like a difference between, okay, we have to make a sequel to Jurassic Park, let's go to the guy who wrote the original novel to write what's going to happen in this one, and go back to Spielberg, who is not only someone who directed the first one, but is someone who directed the only really successful monster film of all time, really.
Yeah.
And hire people who know what they're doing has been replaced by hire people who won't fuck with us.
Yeah.
And it's succeeding, I guess, in the sense that people are going to see the movies, but we'll never get another Jurassic Park because you're not hiring people who can deliver something that strong.
And that's the thing about, like, Spielberg is, the studio loves him, but you watch his films, he has all these, the wonder shots. He has a really distinct style that's very Spielberg, you know, and like with Ant-Man, they hired Edgar Wright, who has an extremely distinct style. And the moment that started fucking with them, they're like, okay, never mind. And yeah, that's what they need, is they sort of have these, their films, they're starting to get shot almost more generic, where the way of any strong directorial style is just not allowed in bigger budget films anymore. Like the Captain America, or the sequel, is directed by the Russo brothers, I believe.
Who are TV directors.
Yeah, exactly. And they're used to adapting styles of producers, and that definitely seems like that's the trend now, is that the importance of a director has been diminished in these newer films.
Yeah, that used to be the way things were. Like, people identified more with the studio than they did with the director. Like, it was like, oh, a Paramount movie, it's gonna have people talking real fast and sexy blonde ladies with curly hair. We know how Paramount does. I don't know if any of those are particularly true, but
that's like what I think about Paramount.
Yeah. But then this kind of idea came about where directors were like the thing that we identify movies with.
That was the new Hollywood era, is where that came from, right?
The Spielbergs and the Scorsese's.
Coppolas.
The Lucases.
And right. I actually drew a parallel between the superhero movies and the new Hollywood in an article I wrote a long time ago for the site about why the rise of superhero movies mirrors the rise of new Hollywood, and then the beginning of its decline has so far mirrored the decline of new Hollywood, in that in the beginning it was directors taking risks on properties, like you had Batman, but it's directed by a guy who knows a lot about Batman and it's super dark, like that's crazy, let's see what Christopher Nolan does here. And Sam Raimi having all these ideas about Spider-Man, and Jon Favreau getting to shoot Iron Man. It had a script, but there was still more, there's like the rumor that it didn't have a script, which is nonsense, but it was a kind of an adventurous shoot, and I think that movie has personality in how it's shot by Favreau. But then as you go on, they're removing Edgar Wright from Ant-Man, and the studios are getting more in control. Joss Whedon's getting pissed off about that, and the same thing happened in New Hollywood, where the studios started taking control of, or it was the opposite, actually. The directors started having their crazy artistic vision go off the rails, and then you get Heaven's Gate, which is this crazy disaster.
Right.
The director was like, no, people will watch a four-hour movie with a 30-minute rollerblading scene where people sing.
That's a thing that's underrated, because we automatically assume that a movie where it's a director's vision is going to be better and more interesting, and there's a way in which that narrative, which I think is driven by the baby boomer generation that has been sort of running culture for the past, you know, they were running it up through like the turn of the millennium, at which point like some younger people who weren't baby boomers started coming into cultural relevance. And I think a lot of these assumptions that we assume are just true are going to like start going away. For instance, the George Lucas thing, the reason that people, first of all, had high expectations for the prequels, the Star Wars prequels, was because the story had been retold from the first three Star Wars movies were these like amazing ensemble things where the studio like told him what to do and like had a tight leash on him. It got retold as George Lucas is this cinematic mastermind, right? Mm-hmm. Like where he did everything. And then when you look at the behind the scenes of like The Phantom Menace, he's just standing there in the middle of the room, just calling the shots out, being like, you know, Jar Jar is the key to all of this. He's the funniest character that's ever been put on film. And showing the actor how he should be moving his arms in this like crazy racist way, because everybody had bought into this idea of like this singular visionary director and like it's one person's vision. And it just seems like it's like that was very much of their generation, to be like one person takes over and he's a maverick and like it's his vision. And I don't know if like the new generation of kids is like that into that whole idea of like just one person being an artist. I feel like millennials are like interested in like marketers and like marketing and like how a movie's marketed. They like admire that, and if marketing is like tricky, they're impressed by that.
That's my big criticism of horror movies, is that they throw no budget on them and then put it all towards viral marketing, and then that's all they need. Like they spend, you know, $6 million making Ouija, and then spend like $20-30 million making like prank videos that advertise Ouija. And it just seems so misplaced at this point. Like, it feels like the movie's almost an afterthought at that point.
But that doesn't seem like a thing that bothers the people going to see Ouija.
No, yeah.
I guess Ouija didn't do that well, but nostalgia is a human constant. I was listening to one of the hardcore histories, and he was like talking about how, I think it was the German army in the First World War was like really driven by nostalgia for like a simpler time, and they just like walk into the battle and just get fucking demolished, and it's like this misguided nostalgia. But I had never heard of like nostalgia being something that is like blinding to past cultures. We all just think of it like, oh, nostalgia for the 80s and 90s or whatever.
Yeah, nostalgia was considered a disease back then. Like, they were actually trying to find a nostalgia bone, like some sort of thing in your body, because it was more about homesickness back then, because we didn't, like, what pop culture do they have to be nostalgia about then? Like, it was more about their hometown and, like, you know, their parents and their family. And right. Nostalgia meant more back then because, yeah, you could go to war and come back and, like, everybody's dead.
Yeah, your town has just totally gone away.
Yeah. And now we're like, oh, they ruined Ninja Turtles.
But it's similar. You're fighting for the same sort of territory, sure. Of, like, it's basically a conservative instinct in a world that is progressing faster than, like, the human mind naturally wants it to.
Yeah. And I think we're definitely tricked by nostalgia, because I went back and watched the Ninja Turtles, and the original cartoon is insane.
They're a disaster.
Yeah,
well, that's interesting that to tie, like, it's just something, it's just memories that we attach to our childhoods are important to us because of the memories they're attached to, rather than...
Right,
that's kind of, and that feeds into the point of why movies aren't actually getting worse. Like, when I go back and watch Aliens, the reason I enjoy it so much is because it's tied to memories of hanging out and the attic with my cousin watching movies I wasn't supposed to be watching because I was too young. And then, you know, it's also a well-made movie, but that's why I love it so much.
It is a well-made movie, and so is Jaws, right? And I watched Jaws 100 times before I was 7 years old and was very proud of that fact.
But I'll never,
main thing.
I'll never love a movie as much as I love Aliens, because when I saw Aliens, it's attached to memories in my head, and then making a bad Alien sequel, it's like going and burning down the village I grew up in. It's the exact same.
Identical.
I think that's why people get mad if you tell them the movies are getting worse, especially younger people, because no one wants to be told that the things that they grew up with are bad. That's my theory with 9/11, is that when they killed Osama bin Laden, colleges were freaking out and no one could figure out why, because it was like, well, what do they care? Like, they were really young for that. And the reason why is, of course, they grew up in this atmosphere that was different than, like, say, me, who was, like, 17 and already cynical when 9/11 happened. So it completely changes my perspective of that and my nostalgia for the movies and the things that were happening during that time.
Yeah, that was the first time that this, like, upcoming generation made me be like, oh, you guys are different than all of us, like, the rest of the world. I think probably in a good way, like, or at least definitely it's not necessarily a bad thing. And I think there's going to be a tendency for the previous sort of regime that I feel like I'm stuck in between, like, Generation X to baby boomers, who will find this new generation to be, like, crazy that they're, like, more collective, or at least they don't need everything to be related to, like, blame one person, give one person all the credit type thing. Social media is really our World War II.
Sure.
And we all, you know.
WoW is our Vietnam.
World of Warcraft?
Yeah.
Oh.
You go and you remember it forever. Some people never come back.
What else? Do we have any other
Well, I do want to talk about a couple things that I think that nostalgia has tricked us on. Because I've been researching a bunch of articles about various people like Adam Sandler, where I'm trying to figure out, has Adam Sandler films gotten worse? And the conclusion I found was that no, like, we're just getting older.
So you went back and watched Happy Gilmore, and it's just,
well,
it's,
if you
not
look at
good.
The reviews for Happy Gilmore are like the same as the reviews for Adam Sandler films now. Like, Roger Ebert hated it. You go back and watch Billy Madison, you're just like, well, this person's just crazy. Like,
there
he's
is
seeing a- penguins, he talks like a child. Like, that's insane. Like, I still love it because that's the movie I grew up with. But, like, when we ask ourselves, like, why does Adam Sandler movies make so much money still? It's like, well, because they're still appealing to the same, like, 13-year-old target audience that goes and sees his movies. I have the same theory with Tim Burton, that we say Tim Burton films have gotten worse, but I think it's just that we've gotten a little older. And sort of our culture has kind of passed him by a little. Like, he was never really meant for CGI. The moment CGI showed up, his films, we stopped considering them good. But his films have always been for children, and his films still make a lot of money. Alice in Wonderland made a shitload of money. Like, we feel like he's gotten worse, but it's just that he's always been for the same target audience that we're passing by.
Yeah, that's interesting. I do wonder if Edward Scissorhands was his best movie, though. It seems like to be the most coherent of his movies, and then everything with him is sort of gets washed around by sort of whatever the studio wants to do with this talented director. Like, the idea of, like, a talented director with that singular of a vision doesn't necessarily fit with the studio model. I mean, with Adam Sandler, it's tough. I read somewhere or heard someone say that, like, kids still really like Adam Sandler movies.
There's a moment in his career when he's stopped being the butt of the jokes in his movies, and he kind of started taking shots at people. I don't know.
It was right after Little Nicky.
Yeah, and I don't know. Because I haven't gone back and watched any of his movies, but I mean, I feel like Happy Gilmore has him beating up Bob Barker in my head is still funny. But if you watch Grown Ups 2, there's nothing funny. There aren't even jokes for a lot of.
I'm not sure who Grown Ups is meant for, but it made a shitload of money, so.
Yeah, it's weird, I don't know. I guess we are just, if we're just passing him by, and tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day until the last syllable of recorded time.
Yeah, that's Adam Sandler's film.
I think Adam Sandler said that.
Yeah.
Our conversation. Hope you enjoyed it. On to footnotes. We heard I Can't Feel My Face by The Weeknd, which is a new song by an old favorite of ours. I've mentioned the song House of Balloons, Glass Table Girls being a favorite of mine on past episodes. And if you missed that episode, go find that song because I can't play it again. I've given myself the strict rule never to replay a song, but it's one of my favorites. The part where it drops halfway through and changes is one of my favorite parts of any song ever. And this might be my second favorite song by him. He's a singer from Toronto, speaks openly about creepy drug use and sexual escapades, and the song makes use of both of those themes in a pretty straightforward way that I think works for him. I think you should try the whole love and sex thing without the many, many drugs, but I don't know, maybe not. He's the expert. This song actually sounds less like past Weeknd songs that I've liked and more like past Michael Jackson songs that I've loved. Maybe if Michael Jackson had done different drugs or not any at all, he would have been better off. Who knows? Zadie Smith just wrote a short story in the New Yorker's Summer Fiction issue that features Michael Jackson driving Elizabeth Taylor and Marlon Brando out of New York across the country to Los Angeles in, I think it's like a Toyota Corolla or something. It's very entertaining, and that ties this song into this week's episode, I guess. But the song's great. It's blown up. You can buy it from your local Sam Goody. We heard Jai Wolf, which is a DJ who's apparently had a bunch of big appearances at Coachella and South By, and it's one of my favorite uses of that sort of Kanye sped-up vocal hook that he sort of innovated and used so frequently and so well on The Blueprint back when he was just
making beats for Jay-Z. And Jai Wolf sort of takes that and makes the kind of sped up vocal hook the main instrument, like the main vocal track in his music. The words are indecipherable, but it really works for me. This song is called Indian Summer, which is approximately what the song feels like. Is that racist, by the way, the term Indian Summer? I need to look into the derivation of that. I'm sure it is. We're running an upcoming article about all the myths we have about Australia after interviewing someone who lives in the outback. And he confirmed something I had long suspected based on conversations I've had with people from Australia, that Australia is super racist. And during that conversation, Robert Evans from our personal experience section pointed out that Australians he has traveled with apparently call the game of telephone, you know, that you play when you're in elementary school, where one kid whispers a message to the next kid and it slowly gets more and more incorrect. In Australia, that is called Chinese whispers, which feels racist in a very Australian way. We'll do a whole episode about Australian racism. No, probably not. Which is all to say, maybe so is Indian Summer. Adorably racist, or not adorably racist, horribly racist. I don't know. I'll look into it. And we heard, and we're going to ride out on Since I Left You by The Avalanches. We've played Frontier Psychiatry by them before on this podcast. The Avalanches are, I think, a couple of DJs from Australia. Look at this perfect stream of ADD logic we're following through the footnotes section, who released this really remarkable album in 2000. God, 15 years ago, pre-9/11 world. Never forget. But all the songs are constructed from various vinyl samples. I think they estimated it was like 3,500 vinyl samples. And they turned it into this brilliant, new, beautiful work of art. There's not a single instrument, original instrument, played by them. Everything's pulled from like a past radio play or some previously recorded album. And I kept being reminded of this album when I was thinking through the intro and this episode and sort of my model for how the human mind processes media and uses it to create memories, because this album feels very like stream of consciousness. It feels like it's happening inside your brain, but it's being created from things you've heard, sounds you've heard, media you've experienced. Anyways, it's one of the great albums of all time, in my opinion, and great album to write to. We mentioned it on last week's episode. I suggest going out and buying it. They haven't released anything since then. They could use a kick in the pants, maybe. Maybe you buying their album will do that. Anyways, that is it for this week. We'll be back next week with more podcast. Talk to you then, guys. Guys, if you're always on the lookout for the next breakthrough smartphone, or even if you're not, like me, there is a really cool product that you need to check out called the Segas V². It has more industry-leading tech than any other phone, up to 464 gigs of storage, a 21-megapixel camera that shoots 4K video, Harman Kardon speakers, lag-free wireless HD streaming to your TV, and it's waterproof, which is a big deal. That's how smartphones get broken, as they get dropped in water. And it's a cool product. It's basically an indie smartphone and a cool company to support.
So go support great tech and disruptive innovation by going to Indiegogo.com and type V squared into the search bar and buy a V squared today.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio, boom.com. The wolf dead.